The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, I'm Avra Lewis for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is the editor's pick, The Culture List. What Corey's into right now? After weeks of binging old series as part of my viewing entertainment, I thought I'd mix in some new projects. With these varied hoots and horrors, I'm happily watching the screen this fall. Number 1, Antebellum, in select theaters, August 21st, is the psychological thriller new filmmakers Gerard Bush and Christopher Renz cross horror fantasy with historical realism in their lead character, celebrated author Veronica, an unapologetic critic of racial and gender inequalities. Veronica is sought after as a speaker, but at a conference in New Orleans, she is kidnapped after a night out with her dear friend. In flashback sequences that toggle between Veronica's Tony life with her daughter and supportive husband and her past life as a field slave on a Louisiana plantation, she is seemingly caught between two vivid worlds. However, through these memories, a bone-chilling question arises. Which of Veronica's lives is real? Number 2, Woke, Hulu, September 9th. When a white fan of cartoonist Keith says he didn't realize Keith was black, the artist blows off the microaggression as a way of maintaining harmony. That is, until his harrowing run-in with cops. The incident awakens Keith's double consciousness as well as random animated objects. Hey, it's a comedy that encouraged him to challenge the racism he's long ignored. Number 3, Power Book 2, Ghost. For 6 seasons on Power, in a big rich town, Ghost and Tommy ruled the streets. In the end, Ghost was no match for his own blood son, Tariq, who killed him. This spinoff picks up with Tariq's mom taking the fall for the murder. But with no money for her get-out-of-jail-free card, the teen follows in his father's hustler footsteps by going into business with drug queen Monet Stewart Tahaja, all while juggling college. That's right, Papa had the last word when Ghost stipulated that Tariq's hefty inheritance would arrive after graduation. Number 4, Tyler Perry's Madea Farewell Play. As he approached turning 50 in March 2019, Tyler Perry confirmed he was retiring the big screen matriarch he created, wrote, directed, and played because he wanted, quote unquote, to do things differently. But hallelujah! The mogul pulls out Madea's housecoat one final time for the stage version starring himself and longtime players Cassie Davis, David Mann, and Tamala Mann. Number 5, Lovecraft Country. Black folk driving through Lovecraft Country in 1954 need these essentials: a copy of the Safe Negro Travel Guide, a lunchbox of hearty snacks, and a flashlight that scares off massive nocturnal tentacled creatures. That's what Atticus, Latia, and George discover as they search for Atticus's father, who sent his son a mysterious letter about his whereabouts. Based on Matt Ruff's 2016 novel and homage to the H.P. Lovecraft fantasy horror subgenre, married with equally terrifying reality of systemic racism in Jim Crow era America, the HBO series is eerily and necessarily right on time. Arts section of Essence, and the title is Fertile Ground. For 10 years, Maurice Harris has been one of Hollywood's go-to florists, but in his Queeby series, the passion behind his artistry comes into full bloom. Have you ever wondered how to find your center? It's a space Maurice Harris claimed ever so wryly not to have a clue about during the opening sequence of episode 6 of his Quibi series, Centerpiece with Maurice Harris. But then he fesses up. Whenever I'm in nature, I try to stay very still, very quiet, he says. That's how I receive my creativity and my messages. Once upon a time, Harris dreamed of becoming a famous fashion designer, but fate had other plans. He is now the co-owner with his younger brother of Los Angeles-based floral design company Bloom & Plume, which has launched a decade ago. In 2019, he followed up with a downtown coffee shop of the same name, which he co-owns with his youngest brother. The eldest of four siblings, Harris hails from a long line of innovative folk whom he credits with planting and watering the seeds of his creative vision. My dad was a pastor of our church, which he started from scratch, Harris notes, so I've seen creation from nothing. As long as his knack for rearranging his mother's furniture, which he began doing as a 7-year-old in their Stockton, California home, he would later follow the example of the family matriarch. My grandmother makes church lady hats and is pretty incredible at it too. She also does a lot with flowers, so I was always watching how she composed and arranged things. I thought it would translate into fashion, but instead it manifested with me continuing her legacy and taking it even further. Centerpieces is an extension of his floral work, yes, but it also offers viewers a peek into the process of fellow artists, including directors and actors like Melina, Rashida Jones, Maya Rudolph, and Tessa Thompson, and singer-songwriter Moses Sumney. I've always been interested in forwarding the conversation on Black creativity, on freedom, on my own version of Black excellence and what that looks like, he says. During each approximately 7-minute episode, for which his mom plays the organ and his sister is known to make cameos, he talks about inspiration with his guest. In response, he makes exquisite floral installations in their honor. It is a win-win for all. Now, as Harris awaits a season to order, fingers crossed. What is he looking forward to next? Well, like a still blossoming flower, there are layers to it. I want to work to be sustainable, so turning Bloom and Plume into a creative agency really interests me, he muses. So does growing the coffee shop and throwing some other things on the screen. I may not know how I'm getting there, but you'll see me there. The next article is titled The Race Subject. After writing a novel based on his experience, Yusuf Salam, one of the exonerated five, offers an inspirational message to Black teens. In 1955, Emmett Till was lynched after being accused of whistling at a white woman. 65 years later, Ahmaud Arbery was murdered for jogging near his own neighborhood. Breonna Taylor was killed by police in her home, and George Floyd struggled against a knee on his neck, begging for his life as he pleaded, "I can't breathe." Calling the names of our lost brothers and sisters, people have poured into the streets protesting in the midst of pandemic and shouting Black Lives Matter. Like me, they are also asking, why does this keep happening? The truth is the systemic injustices that Black men and women face have persisted for centuries. Black people are continually seen as suspects, and in many cases, we are judged guilty before we can even mount a defense. Our skin is the charge against us. I know all too well about what it is like to be convicted of a crime you did not commit. Having been charged and imprisoned alongside four other innocent black and brown brothers, I know the rage, anger, and frustration that come when people assume you are guilty because you are black. I know the feeling of hopelessness at seeing black people brutalized again and again for doing nothing more than simply living their lives. How do we ensure this moment is different? By being loud, unafraid, unapologetic, and unified. We must occupy every space possible, channeling our rage into a voice that echoes from the streets to the voting booth. We must also continue to work together as a community, because only unity can sustain us in the face of so much that can divide us. We are all hurting, but one lesson I learned while wrongfully incarcerated was that instead of going through something, we can grow through something. Together, we can remake this criminal system of injustice into one that truly protects and serves. The next article is titled Suffrages, Then and Now. These advocates made sure black women had a seat at the voting table. August marked a century since the ratification and official adoption of the 19th Amendment. This landmark law proclaimed that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. Surely this legislation should have granted every American woman the right to vote. However, this amendment did not fully protect the voting rights of all women. It primarily guaranteed the voting rights of white women. In this oversight, the 19th Amendment echoed the sentiments of the women's suffrage movement as a whole, though both the amendment and the movement appeared to encompass the entire spectrum of women. In fact, black women were often relegated to the back of protest marches, with suffrage leaders failing to consider, much less understand, how black women exist at the intersection of race and gender, and are marginalized by both. Thousands of black women had organized, marched, lobbied, and participated in the struggle for voting rights, yet their interests and issues did not make it onto the agenda for most white suffrages. Black women actively endured the trials and tribulations of the suffrage movements, but they were, and still are, largely shut out of both the victories and the commemorations. In 1851, at the Women's Rights Convention, abolitionist Sojourner Truth delivered her renowned "Ain't I a Woman" speech, specially illuminating black women's exclusion from the institution of womanhood. "I have borne 13 children and seen most all sold off to slavery. And when I cried out my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman?" Like many black suffragists, Sojourner championed the idea that race and gender were inextricable. The term intersectionality would not be coined until more than a century later. Yet black suffragists understood black women's dual social caste. As civil rights activist and suffragette Mary Church Terrell remarked, "A white woman has only one handicap to overcome, that of sex. I have two, both sex and race. I belong to the only group in the country which has two such huge obstacles to surmount. Colored men have only one, that of race." Within the suffrage movement, there was hardly a place for black women. That is, of course, until black suffragettes forged one. In 1896, Terrell, along with fellow activists like Harriet Tubman, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, and Ida B. Wells Barnett, founded the National Association of Colored Women, a fusion of several local black women's clubs. The NACW took on the varied interests of black women, from anti-segregation to suffrage. The words of the organization's motto, "Lifting as we climb," were Terrell's own. One of the founders, Wells, later established the Alpha Suffrage Club in Chicago in 1913 when a suffrage parade was organized in Washington, D.C. Wells and her group were invited to attend. There was one striking condition, however. Wells and the black women of the Alpha Suffrage Club would have to march at the end of the parade, upholding segregation. Wells renounced this condition and instead, her group cleverly joined the Illinois delegation in the middle of the parade. During her life, Wells crusaded against the atrocities of lynching and mobilized thousands of black women to register to vote, canvass, and educate others on the critical importance of going to the polls. The 19th Amendment's official ratification in 1920, paired with the adoption in 1870 of the 15th Amendment, which states that the right of the citizens to vote shall not be denied or abridged on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude, should have provided universal voting for all black people. Instead, state laws still methodically disenfranchise blacks seeking to cast a ballot by requiring literacy tests, character assessments, and payment of poll taxes. Beyond these obstacles, black people who attempted to go to the polls were often met with threats and violence. In the 1960s, the civil rights movement transformed the fight for suffrage by registering voters, dismantling discriminatory laws, and resisting the violence and threats that black families encountered when they attempted to exercise their rights. In 1964, Fannie Lou Hamer told the Democratic National Convention that she was sick and tired of being sick and tired. Hamer had been a frequent target of antagonism, intimidation, and violence as she registered black families to vote through the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and advocated for equal voting rights for black people. By the time she made it to the DNC in 1964, after helping to found the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party during Freedom Summer, Hamer had a specific demand that the Convention's Credentials Committee award the MFDP seats as Mississippi delegates. Her insistence on representation mirrored communities of black people across the nation who desperately wanted to see themselves in the bodies that governed them. Hamer, Shirley Chisholm, and numerous other black women carried the banner for those communities, mobilizing black candidates to run for political offices. In 1965, the Voting Rights Act was passed to bar racial discrimination in voting. Black women suffragists, advocates, organizers, and activists took the lead in forging creative and impactful campaigns that led to the passing of this legislation. They understood, however, that just as the struggle at the ballot box had not ended with the 19th Amendment, it would not magically cease 45 years later when Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. The spirit of the suffragists and abolitionists lives on today as we continue to confront the disenfranchisement of voters in our communities. Now, as then, black women are leading the charge, with Stacey Abrams way out in front as one of our most dynamic. As the first woman to lead any party in the Georgia Assembly and the first black person to serve as a leader in the state's House of Representatives, Abrams is no stranger to blazing trails. To say she is fed up by voter disenfranchisement would be an understatement. on the heels of her 2018 Georgia gubernatorial campaign, which featured egregious acts of voter suppression, Abrams launched Fair Fight to ensure voter protections in battleground states. She also started several other organizations dedicated to voter education, registration, and protection, including Fair Count and the New Georgia Project. Black women have been and remain integral to the success of American liberation movements. In light of this summer's uprisings, in response to police brutality, ongoing systemic racism, and social institutions entrenched in white supremacy, now is the perfect time to make a stand. In this moment, everything is possible, even a black woman as vice president. But we must be willing to seize everything that has historically been kept from us, including the right to exercise our power at the polls. The next article is titled, 10 Things We Are Talking About. Number 1, say her name. Breonna Taylor was fatally shot by officers of the Louisville Metro Police Department in Kentucky on March 13, 2020. Delayed justice regarding her death has reignited chants to protect black women, amplify our names, and ensure that our lives and stories are never forgotten in the fight for reform. Number 2, banking black. In allyship with Black Lives Matter, Netflix has moved $100 million in deposits to black-owned banks, positioning these financial institutions to better serve our communities. Number 3, dismantling racism. The Boston Art Commission has voted to remove the Emancipation Group, a statue of a formerly enslaved man kneeling in front of Abraham Lincoln. Some view the sculpture as racist for its portrayal of black subjugation. Number 4, prime time takeover. Black women are changing the face of nightly news. In July, Joy Ann Reed became the first black woman to lead an evening news show on MSNBC. The Readout's debut came just weeks after Revolt TV launched Revolt Black News, hosted and executive produced by attorney and author Ebony K. Williams. Number 5, protect black women. Journalist Isha Cisse, in partnership with actor and fellow Briton of Sierra Leone descent Idris Elba, is raising money through the newly formed Survivors Solidarity Fund to help women and children who are victims of sexual assault in Sierra Leone find healing and justice. Number 6, be counted. The 2020 census is nearing completion, and black households must make sure they are counted. Congressional seats, electoral college votes, and billions of dollars are at stake. Visit 2020census.gov to respond today. Number 7, HBCU bound. Star high school b-ball player Makar Maker has committed to attending Howard in the fall. HBCU Jump, a new campaign aimed at getting more athletes at black schools, has a mission to make sure he's not the only one. The network of alumni, athletes, and advocates is driving an HBCU movement with hopes of changing the college game. Number 8, Black Lives Matter. With systemic racism and excessive policing once again in the headlines, cities across the nation are taking a stand in the fight for racial equity. Washington, D.C., New York City, and San Francisco are among the many that have painted the rallying cry for the protection of black lives on major thoroughfares. Montgomery, Alabama's Court Square Fountain, a former slave auction site, also received a social justice renovation. Number 9, the 1619 Project on TV and at the movies. New York Times journalist Nicole Hannah Jones is bringing her much-discussed initiative to the big and small screens. Lionsgate, with the help of Oprah Winfrey, will adapt the 1619 project into feature films and a television series. Number 10, Out of Blood. The American Red Cross is making a strong push for African Americans to give blood. Since the start of COVID-19 pandemic, the organization's life-saving centers have seen a drop in black donors, sparking concern for those with disorders like sickle cell disease. The next article is titled, Back to the Books. As our children and teens return to school, here are five must-reads to help them navigate the racial pandemic and empower them to love their full selves. Award-winning duo Derek N. Barnes and Gordon C. James remind black boys that they are divinely created in I Am Every Good Thing, 1799. Next, meet Jeremiah, who's dealing with the haunting effects of gun violence, in the book Four Beautiful Black Boys Who Believe in a Better World, $18 by Michael W. Waters and Keisha Morris. In Christina Hammond's reads, The Black Kids, 1899, a privileged black teen's world gets rocked after the 1992 Rodney King riots. Have an open discussion after reading The Talk, Conversations about Race, Love, and Truth, 1699, edited by Wade Hudson and Cheryl Willis Hudson. Nick Stone introduces us to an incarcerated teen in the YA sequel, Dear Justice, 1899, and sheds light on the workings of the criminal justice system. We have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you have enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Ava Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service and have a great day.